नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स अपारुथा दे संगमथसथवरा ये सौरवन्था बमुञ्चन्तु सदा। So this is the Upasita, and we've all reaffirmed our commitment to the Sila, the conventions around bodily action and speech, agreements that we have, limitations that we accept on regards to what we do and what we say. So every fortnight, this is a part of this tradition to reaffirm this, so that like the bhikkhus did the Patimokkha, with Ajahn Lasaji recited the Patimokkha in 38 minutes. That's quite good, you know, for 227 rules. But that's not the point, however. just the sense of this discipline as it's kept in this form of the 227 Patimokkha rules for the bhikkhus. Some people want it to be more functional, like to do it in English, you know, where we can understand what they're saying. But actually, it functions quite well, I've found over the years, of as a focus. Every fortnight, new moon and full moon nights or days where these 227 rules are recited in the Pali, and one monk takes on that duty and the rest of us sit and listen. So this is, but it does give this sense of a kind of commitment and reaffirming and bonding, a sense of a bond or something that holds us together in regards to how we're going to live with each other, real relationship to each other, to the material world, the society that we live in. And I remember when I first ordained as a bhikkhu in Thailand, and I went and I heard my first Patimokkha, having a skeptical mind and being American, you can be quite opinionated, as I was. I said, what a waste of time. You know, they sound like tobacco auctioneers. You know, they're just saying something nobody, might as well just, you know, say nonsense syllables for half an hour and see, that'll do just as well. And kind of cynic and critic was brought up. I was impressed that the monk could recite all this, you know, without looking at any text. That impressed me, I thought. But still, that's a waste of time. I'm not going to bother doing that. So I took on this position, this opinion. I'm not going to waste my time doing that silly thing. And so then 5 years later, I did it. And I remember the kind of thrill of being doing my first Patimokkha at Tam Sang Pen up in Amnat Chilern, and it's quite a performance, you know, the first Pratfrong Western monk to do this, and I found, you know, really quite enjoyed doing it. So it's these traditions, that's, you know, are they absolutely essential, or are they just Thilapatta Paramartha, or just rites and rituals, superstitions? And this is where this sense of awakened awareness is the essential thing, because the conventions that we use can be Thilapatta Paramartha, superstitious, and so forth, if we hold them in the wrong way. We look at them in terms of attaching identity, fear, and desire. Or if we use them with a sense of awakeness, then they have a different function. They work in a different way. So I'm trying to put blame on the religious conventions. I've listened to some critics on religion who think of any religion as some kind of waste of time, belief in things you can't prove, and on and on like this, how well the atheists or the skeptics, agnostics can blame religion as the cause of war. The example now, what they call the Islamic terrorists. There's so much effort now here in England, isn't there, in the UK and the United States to say this is not a war against Islam, you know. Islam is a peaceful religion, and kind of reiterating this over and over again. And yet, to many people, it's, the jihad and the terrorist movement and that is very strongly identified with one particular religion, Islam. And then we can form an opinion about Islam and just through some biased views, cultural prejudices, and so forth, and not really, and condemn the whole religion because of their fundamentalist or terrorist or whatever you want to call them, because they, you know, how I see it is they just use the convention in the wrong way. When we think of religion also in terms of the skeptics and critics look at religion as the cause of so many divisions, so much suffering and war in the past, and yet when you ask them to think of all the good things that religions have produced, they sometimes can't do it. When you think of just in the Western world, in Christianity, all the good things that have been, you know, the result of some kind of faith or religious practice, belief within the parameters of Christianity. I remember reading a book years ago about all the corruption of the popes over the years in the Roman Catholic Church. By the time I finished the book, it only had all the corrupt things that popes ever did. You know, all the illegitimate children, various immoral acts, greed, hatred, and delusion that the various popes over 2,000 years have committed. And by the time I finished the book, I thought, oh, that, you know, you're totally convinced the Roman Catholic Church was totally, absolutely bad. Because the mind was, those were all the facts, the items of information was on all the bad things. And then I thought, well, what if somebody did that to me, you know, I just somebody wrote a biography of Ajahn Sumedho, and all they wrote down were the bad things of my life. When I told a lie. When I did something, when I said something cruel, and when I did something bad, and that was my biography. What would you think? You know, a horrible person. So in this thinking mind, we can, you know, this is why you can't really trust it, because it's so easy to prove your bias. You know, if you've got a prejudice or a view against any group or individual, you can always find enough unpleasant facts to kind of prove your point. You know, so it's to prove that you're right. So that in terms of this awakeness that the Buddha emphasized, this is not a rational function of the mind. This is the natural state of conscious experience. It's not has no bias in it. It includes, it embraces everything from the good and the bad, the good and evil forces. At this time when we think of the war that's taking place, this war against evil that President Bush is engaging in. And he calls it the war against evil. The United States is going to wipe out evil from the world, or the terrorists. Terrorism is evil, and we've got to wipe it out. And so that this sounds like a very righteous cause, and yet the opposite side, Bin Laden, feels the United States, the Americans, Bush are evil forces. So it's how you want to look at it, isn't it? I'm sure, you know, who's calling who evil. And then the kind of simplistic logic that comes out of that is you wipe out the evil forces. So you just bomb Afghanistan into, you know, to as one big crater in the ground. That's what they're trying to do. Just keep trying to destroy the evil forces through committing terrible acts ourselves. You know, using terrorist tactics to wipe out terrorism is what's actually how I see what's taking place. This is a sense of who's calling who a terrorist. But of course God is on our side, not on theirs. I mean, they think the opposite. So how can you resolve this? You know, who's unless you manage to totally terrorize the other side to where they submit grudgingly out of just survival. Or in the awakened mind, isn't there room for both? The Americans, Bin Laden, terrorism, Buddhist monasteries in Hertfordshire, monks and nuns, Israelis and Palestinians. Isn't there room for everything? Because the awakened consciousness has no bias, has no preferences. We reflect that evil belongs also. Evil is a part of our experience of life. What's bad, what's evil, what's dirty, what's horrible, what's terrible. This is a part of life. These kind of conditions arise and a part of our human experience. So they also belong in this realm. this realm is like this. So we're reflecting on the way it is, on the conditioned realm that we're very much experiencing at this moment. And so we can look outward into what's happening on the international scene, or to really examine it closely, we look at what's happening internally, what goes on in one's own mind. And you can see the terrorists that you create, or the tyrants, or the jackals, or the superego, or the whatever, the things that are constantly criticizing or diminishing or persecuting yourself. And that we're very good at terrorizing ourselves, hating ourselves, criticizing and putting down, nagging, blaming ourselves, if we begin to look at what goes on in one's own conscious experience. Self-hatred, self-disparagement is all the kind of terrorism, isn't it? And so the terrorist is a part of our human experience. We think, well, we shouldn't do this, it's wrong, we should love ourselves. That's another idea, because the shoulds are about how what are the ideals, how life should be, what human society should be, what a good monk or a good nun should be. These are ideas or ideals. But at this moment, we're awakened to the way it is, which is like this. The dualistic mind, the conditioning of the mind, it of course does. We take sides. We want to get rid of evil and promote goodness. We want life to be just and fair and merciful, and we don't want tyrants and terrorists and criminals and psychopaths and evil kind of serial killers and all those nasty things, and trying to get rid of that, or trying to annihilate the evil forces, is a kind of logic that comes from being attached to goodness. Thinking itself is like this. When we attach to our thinking process, this is what we do. How many of you can detach from thinking? You know, when you try to just think your way through Buddhism, what happens? You know, when you just grasp the ideas and the logic and the teachings and that of that we have in the scriptures. Well, it is a good way to think, you know, so it does have its benefits to think like a Buddhist, to develop Buddhist ways of thinking, Buddhist ideas, Buddhist ideals, Buddhist conventions. They all have, if you're going to grasp something, grasp those. There's a lot of goodness and wisdom in those conventions. But if all we ever do is grasp them, then we're never liberated. And so we become Buddhists who can be quite blind. We can have our own biases and prejudices. You hear it in the Buddhist world here in Britain about strong views about other forms of Buddhism. In the Mahayana, Hinayana, and Zen and Vajrayana and Western Buddhist order and Nukadampa, sect and Nichiren, Japanese Sangha, Korean, Tibetan, Thai, Cambodian, on and on like this. You can divide it up into which is the best. You know, when you have a list of what you grade from 1 to 10, who's at the top? Who's number one? And then it's easy too, you know, of course we, of course Theravada is, we know that. But it's not if we're at some other place. But it's this is the limitation of thinking, isn't it? Want something, you have to put something first, another one second. And then we can dismiss all the other religions. Like I was brought up as a Christian, and we were told all the other religions were wrong. So then I asked my parents if they knew anything about other religions. No, they didn't know anything. Well then how do you know they're wrong? Well they are, because they're not Christian. And then we were then in the particular Christian group, we were Church of England, actually, Episcopal Church in America, and we were high church. So the listing went, the high church, Anglican high church was number one. This was the list that I grew up with. That was at the top of the list, and then various forms of more Catholic type, like Roman Catholicism, Orthodox, came after that. Protestants were at the bottom. My parents were prejudiced against Protestants. And in the very pits, at the, you know, way below the bottom of the list were the Christian Scientists. So my parents were incredibly prejudiced against Christian Scientists. So I grew up thinking, you said Christian Science and they go, get into a real fit. And so I didn't even know anything about it, what was so wrong about it. But I remember when you're brought up in that kind of situation, the word Christian Science, and you kind of contract. So one amusing experience of my life was one time I was at Wat Banana Chak and somebody said, I've got this really interesting tape, would you like to hear it? And I said, yeah, okay. So we played the tape. I said, oh, that's really interesting. It's like Buddhism. What is it? They said, Christian Science. I go, oh. And if somebody said, Ajahn Sumedho, I want you to listen to a tape on Christian Science, I probably wouldn't have listened. I thought, oof, no, can't be bothered. But because they didn't name it, this is experiences of one's life, how conditioning works. We get these kind of things through our culture, through our religion, through our identity of any sort, with the class that we identify with, or the race, or the ethnic group, or the tribe, or the club. So the awareness then is the way that includes all these things. You know, it's not preferring. There's no lists. There's nothing at the, you know, we're not asked to rate anything anymore from 1 to 10 or 1 to 100, but it all belongs. From the Christian Scientists belong just as much as the High Church Anglicans. The Theravadan Buddhists of the Ajahn Chah Forest tradition, along with the Theravadan Buddhists that don't practice meditation, the town monks, the bad monks, the Brahmic monks, They would still belong. There's nothing that they don't belong to this realm. All of this belongs, as well as the arahants, the Sakadakamis, Anakamis, and the Sotapannas, and the Vatuchanas. So, now this reflect on how this sense of including, of non-discrimination, and yet it's not a kind of washover, is it? We're not kind of just whitewashing something and just trying to ignore differences, but what I'm trying to do is put into perspective, to trust in this awareness rather than in any condition, no matter how good or lovely or perfect that condition might be, not to hold that and bind yourself to that, but to allow it to be what it is. So the way of practice, developing the Eightfold Path, is the way of mindfulness. So in our own commitment to this particular convention, to the Dhamma Vinaya and the Theravada tradition, this is, remember, it's only a convention. It's to be used with mindfulness. And that's the purpose of it. If we don't use it with mindfulness, then it is Silabhatta Paramasa, or clinging to rites and rituals, conventions, and so forth. Like when you take on the Upasambhada, the Bhavacha, or the eight precepts or five precepts, these are not kind of conventions that you're supposed to bind yourself to. But they're conventions you can use for developing awareness. It's like an empowerment, giving you the right, or giving you the empowerment to use these for awareness. To be aware of what, in regards to developing awareness around action, what you do, physically do, or what you say. So they are restraints on action and speech. And that is something to... And how we hold that restraint, we can see it in terms of kind of punishing practice, an asceticism. We've got to control ourselves. We've got to bind ourselves to limitation, to morality, because if we don't, we'll just be carried away by the evil temptations of this realm, is one way of looking at it. And then it's the evil forces will get you if you don't, if you don't kind of fight and resist them. We can see them as kind of commandments, the moral imperatives that intimidate us. That your worth is depending on how moral how well you live under this discipline, how good you are in your actions and speech, and so your whether you're any good or not depends, your approval rating goes according to how good you keep the precepts. If you're a really good monk or good nun, and you get gold stars on your report cards every year. This is one way, like childlike version of it, isn't it? But say, with awareness then, we're learning how to use a convention, to hold a convention, to know when this convention is appropriate, when it's not, to be able to develop a sense of what to do, what to say, how to respond in particular situations that we cannot predict, can we? Life is has its contingencies that we have no way of controlling. Very little. We can't just is a, trying to fit life, all of life's experiences into the limitations of a convention is asking too much. But the convention then becomes something that helps us, to gives us something to reflect from, to be able to see, to be able to be aware of what we're actually feeling or thinking in this very moment. And this helps us to say, if we have no restraint on action and speech, then it's easy to, we just tend to follow the momentum, the impulses of the moment, the things that everyone else does. Just follow the crowd, or just be caught in just our own kind of frustrations around the way we do things. Or we limit ourselves according to our own ideas or our own biases or desires or prejudices. And because this tradition is not something that any of us have created ourselves, it's not something, it's not mine that I've made up. It is, has a long tradition from 2,500 years, so it has a kind of a lineage that is quite pleasing to me anyway. And the fact that it isn't something that I created, the fact that I'm having to use something that I may not be told wholeheartedly behind in the Theravada system. There are a lot of things I don't particularly like. It doesn't mean that I like the whole thing or agree with everything in it. I think that it is absolutely the best and there's no flaws and it's absolutely perfect and you should never, you should be totally committed because it was left by the Buddha, it's created by the Buddha, and we have no right to change it in any way, and we've got to absolutely accept it and love it because it's perfect, is one way of holding it. Or in learning to trust one's own satipanya, to be able to know when things really, how we feel, how these restraints, what they bring up into consciousness. Basically, it's based on something that I have no objection to, doing good and refraining from doing evil. And also of restraint and renunciation, this sense of simplifying life, living as an alms mendicant. Our life is based on a commitment to a way of living that generates the sadha or the faith that allow us to live committed to this particular form, this lifestyle. It's like also when you, like when you take on something, like when you get married to somebody, isn't it? Nobody ever expects to marry a perfect person. When you marry somebody, you more or less marry the whole being, there, as they say, warts and all. So if your wife has skinny elbows, you just learn to accept that and not make that a source of endless aversion. Maybe that's not particularly appealing to you, but it's okay. There's nothing particularly that bad about it. In the tradition, they becoming a monk, that's like getting married in a way. So it's with its good points, its benefits, and its skinny elbows, and its clumsiness, and so forth. This is part of the learning process, isn't it? Is learning how, learning from a convention, being able to use it for awakened attention, rather than think, I've got to have the very best. You know, I've got to have the very best convention. Without this, without that, and you know, that's really, you know, I don't want this, I don't, so some people pick and choose out of the conventions they align themselves with, and according to what they like or don't like, they don't see what they're doing. They're picking and choosing rather than observing, witnessing love and hate and liking and disliking. So recognize this, the, you know, this, what the holy life really is. It's an awakening, using our conscious experience, and the only one that can use it is oneself. All that we're left with is this point here. And you know, so that's all there is in terms of this moment, this consciousness. When I totally rest in consciousness, pure consciousness of this present moment, you know, then it's, you know, there's no suffering. I can really observe non-suffering. Purity. Non-self, there's nothing personal in it. It's not like an attainment of mine. Not like I've attained it as a person. It's natural. It's ordinary. It's nothing special. And yet, because of that, the desire forms that we attach to, we're always looking for peaks, isn't it? When we meditate, we want to attain peak moments. We want insight, we want satori, we want, you know, bliss, we want enlightenment, we want to get something that we don't have. Or we want to get rid of our defilements, kill our kilesas, clean ourselves up, attain purity, because we get rid of our impurities so we can become pure. And then that is the two extremities, isn't it? The pure and the impure. The peak moment, or the summit, or the nadir of despair, the pits of hell, and the bliss of heaven. So awakened awareness includes both heaven and hell in the same moment. Doesn't prefer one over the other. Heaven and hell belong. So where does that leave me in my practice, right? Only in the to trust in the awakened attention of this moment, not in, and to be able to reflect on any kind of feeling I have that I've got to get something, I've got to do something. These compulsive habits that we have, and there's always this, I've got to get something I don't have yet. I've got to get rid of, if I have something that's not very nice right now, I've got to get rid of it. Get rid of my bad mood. Get rid of my anger. And try to attain happiness. But the awareness includes both, so it includes those kind of thoughts also. One can begin to notice this compulsive thing in oneself, desire to attain something, to become something, desire to get rid of something that you have right now that you don't like and don't want. So what can you trust in? These desires are changing. They change. There's nothing permanent about them. They go all over the place. So the constant factor is in the awareness. So, and on the bigger scale, then Bin Laden, President Bush, they belong, both equal value. The Islamic terrorists and the righteous Americans, they all belong. Well, when we when we recognize this, then it changes from the war mentality, doesn't it? Of course, don't expect it it's going to happen on the international scale, but it can. In here, this is where it counts, because what's happening politically and internationally is a result of what happens in the mind, in the heart. Now it starts here. And so this is where we start from where we are. What we can at least do this. We can know this. You know, that this is if we can do this, then this is definitely something of benefit to all sentient beings, to both Bush and Bin Laden, to the terrorists and the anti-terrorists. So this is something quite practical and realistic in terms of we can do it all the time, right now. It's not something you have to go away. You don't have to go to Afghanistan to do it. Do it right here, at this moment, wherever here is. So this is beginning to put us back into what the potential that each one of us has as a human being. You know, this occasion, this opportunity, this birth, in this incarnation, in this human form. You know, this is how we can use it, how we can cultivate and live and be a benefit to the society, to all sentient beings, to the universe, when you reflect on it in this way. Because this conscious moment is a universal one. It's not personal. It's not something I create. Ajahn Sumedho creates it. It's not like that. I can create my own thoughts and memories and I have my own kind of emotional habits that can be triggered off quite easily. But this consciousness isn't something I create. It's not personal. Not even Buddhist. It's before Buddhism and Islam and Christianity It's the potential where all conditioned phenomena can arise and cease. There's no consciousness, there's no phenomena. So beginning to recognize, know this. This is knowable. This is realizable. This is not abstract philosophy. This is not some kind of altruism or idealism or airy-fairy idea. This is quite this is real, this is accurate. And based on the simple ability of awakened attention in the present. Nothing can be more simple than that. Counting your breath is much more complicated. At this time where all this paranoia is, you know, there's so much, there's this anthrax, this the kind of biological warfare. President Bush advised Americans not to open strange looking letters and packages. Things are happening with this fear of this anthrax, some kind of germ that will be spread among the human population, or of being bombed or gassed, or well, there's dangers everywhere now. And that the sense of you can trust now that we're somehow living here in Britain, we're completely safe. We're not like living in Rwanda or in Colombia or Afghanistan, some place like that. But or the United States. At least here in Britain, we've had the IRA and various bombings to deal with. But in the United States, I think that was such a shock, the 11th of September, to be attacked from within. But it's also an awakening thing, isn't it? It's suddenly the assumed a security. You is no longer there. You can't assume that anything's all that safe. And so, in one of his reflections, this reflection, this memento mori, the remembering, we're going to die. That death is possible at any moment. That we reflect on death quite intentionally as something that is going to happen, whether it's the next moment or 50 or 100 years from now, not the point, is it? That it will happen. It's because it's part of our experience. And it's all of us in 100 years, you know, all of us will be dead. So this reflection on death awakens us that life is like this. This present moment is important because it's what's existing, what's happening, the way it is now. And we begin to trust more in this awareness rather than holding to views about meditating and developing all kinds of meditation skills so that in the future we can become enlightened. So that's one way of looking at Buddhist monasticism. We'll practice hard, get our jhanas, study the Abhidhamma, do everything to eventually, someday, before we die, it might happen if we work hard enough at it. And so that's still caught in the delusion of time as reality, and that there's a future, and that I'm a person who needs to do something and has to get something I don't have and get rid of things I have that are in the way, that are obstruction. So at this moment, what I can know is if these kind of feelings are present, they're like they are. They are what they are. This compulsive feeling, I've got to get something. I've got to become something. And I can be aware of that, and not criticizing it, just knowing. Bhava dhanha, it's like this. Vipava dhanha, gama dhanha, desire, the way it is. Desire is like this. That which is aware the awakened consciousness is not desire. So you take your refuge in that awakenedness rather than in a desire, no matter how good or noble or altruistic or beautiful the desire may be. That learning to trust this simple imminent act of awareness, mindfulness, path to the deathless, apamado matapada. How many times have you heard me say this? Doing the reflection on the time for paranoia and fear, the enemies behind every bush, lurking in the shadows. You don't know where they are. They're not like the old days, the Cold War. You knew who your enemy was. The Russians. But now we don't know who our enemies are. And so we, this is from American position. But in terms of Dhamma, isn't it? What is the real enemy in terms of right now? And then you can see it's the ignorance of Dhamma is the enemy. So they awaken. And an awakenness, then you know the enemies like this. You know what the enemy is. You know, it's not a matter of assuming there's an enemy or thinking or creating or projecting enemies all over the place, but recognizing ignorance, greed, hatred, delusion are like this. They are the way they are. So your refuge is in awakened awareness rather than in anything else, anything whatsoever. So I offer this as a reflection for this evening.